Unless otherwise indicated, Ratchet Book Club is intended for a mature audience. Viewer discretion is greatly advised. Welcome to Ratchet Book Club, where we read hood classics and good classics. I'm Derek. 916-633-1537, ratchetandratchet@gmail.com, Ratchet Book Club on Twitter, Ratchet Book Club on Facebook. Chapter 17. Punchinello swung the sledge and broke blocks. Honker cut the rebar as it was uncovered. Crinkles moved the debris to the bottom of the stairs and out of the way. They were remarkably efficient and coordinated for a trio of clowns. Each time the Punchinello paused to rest, allowing Honker to use the acetylene torch, he stepped as far away from his companion as possible to avoid the spark showering off the rebar. And each time, he consulted his wristwatch. Obviously, they had calculated the time the power company would need to repair the transformer and were confident with their conclusion. They didn't appear to be nervous. Crazy, yes, but not in the least anxious. My watch was on my left wrist, so I could check it without disturbing Lori, who was shackled to my right arm. Not that she took a nap as we leaned back against the cozy metal filing cabinets. She was wide awake and, I'm sure this will be no surprise to you, talking. I wish my father had been a clown, she said wistfully. Why would you want to live with such anger every day? My father wouldn't be an angry clown. He's a sweet-tempered man, just irresponsible. He wasn't around much, huh? Always off chasing tornadoes, she said. I decided to ask, why? He's a storm chaser. That's how he makes his living, traveling the Midwest in his souped-up Suburban. This was 1994. The movie Twister wouldn't be released until 1996. I had never imagined chasing tornadoes could be a career. Assuming that this had to be a put-on, I played along. Has he ever caught one? Oh, dozens. What's he do with them? Sells them, of course. So, once he's caught a tornado, it's his? He has a right to sell it? Of course. It's copyrighted. So, he sees a tornado, and he chases after it, and when he gets close enough, they're fearless, she said. They get right in there. So he gets right in there, and then he what? You can't just shoot a tornado as if it were a lion on the veld. Sure you can, she said. It's pretty much exactly the same. This was beginning to seem less like a put-on than like a kind of madness that Punchinello might embrace. Would your father sell to me? If you had the money. I don't think I could afford an entire tornado. They must be expensive. Well, she said, it depends on what you want to use it for. I was thinking I could threaten Chicago with it, you know, demand $10 million, maybe $20 million, or else. She regarded me with clear impatience and with what might have been pity. Like I haven't heard that lame joke a million times. I began to suspect that I was missing something. I'm sorry, I want to know, really. Well, partly he charged by how much video you want to buy. A minute? 2 minutes? 10? Video. Film. Of course, he wasn't out there lassoing tornadoes. I had become so accustomed to her cockeyed conversation that when she said her father chased tornadoes, I hadn't been able to believe that she meant exactly what she said. If you're a scientist, she continued, he charged you a lower rate than he'd charge a television network or a movie studio. Geez, that really is dangerous work. Yeah, but it seems like even if he had been a clown, that wouldn't have been a cakewalk either. She sighed. I just wish he had been around more when I was a kid. The tornado season doesn't last all year. No, it doesn't. But he also chases hurricanes. I guess he figures he's already geared up for it. That's exactly what he figures. When one season ends, the other's beginning. So then he's tracking weather reports along the Gulf Coast and the Atlantic seaboard. At the top of the stairs, the three larcenous jack puddings had opened a hole large enough to afford them entrance to the vault. With flashlights, Punchinello and Crinkles disappeared through the broken masonry. Honker stayed behind, keeping a watch on us from the landing. When the generator didn't come on after the power went off, Lori said, maybe an automatic alarm went out over the phone line, and the police are in the bank right now. Although I hoped her unshakable optimism would prove justified, I said, these guys would have covered that. They seem to have thought of everything. She fell silent. So did I. I suspected that our thoughts were occupied with the same worry. Would Punchinello keep his promise to let us go? His cohorts were going to be the problem. Neither of them seemed tightly wrapped, but they weren't insane in the way that the son of the great Conrad Bezo was insane. Their feet were more solidly on the ground than his. Honker was motivated by greed. Crinkles by greed and envy. They would not be in the least sentimental about the son of Rudy Tock. Silence sucked. Worry thrived in it. I felt better just hearing Lori talk, so I tried to start her up again. I'm surprised your mother and you didn't travel with your father. If I were married to a storm chaser who was away from home all the time, I'd want to be with him. Well, her. Mom has her own successful business. She loves it, and if she left L.A., she'd have to give it up. What business is she in? I asked. She's a snake handler. This seemed promising. Lori said, having a mother who's a snake handler isn't as much fun as you'd think. Really? I think it would be a delight. Sometimes, yeah, but she worked out of our home. Snakes, they aren't as easy to train as puppies. Can you housebreak a snake? I'm not talking about potty training. I'm talking tricks. Dogs love to learn stuff, but snakes get bored easily. When they're bored, they try to slither away, and sometimes they can move fast. Punchinello and Crinkles came out of the vault, onto the high landing where Honker waited for them. They were carrying boxes which they put down and from which they removed the lids. Honker whooped when he saw the contents. The three men laughed and high-fived one another. I figured the boxes contained something more exciting than either snakes or pastries. Chapter 18. They brought 16 boxes out of the vault, carried them down the stairs, and loaded them on the handcart that had previously held the explosives. These were cardboard cartons with removable lids, similar to the kind in which movers pack books. Over $3 million in cash, Punchinello said when he urged Lori and me to our feet and led us to the loot. I remembered something he said earlier. To all appearances, it's not a major bank, not worth knocking over. There wouldn't be this much cash on hand in most big city banks, Punchinello said. This is a Treasury Department collection center for what's called fatigued currency. All banks cull worn currency from circulation. Those in the 12 county districts send it here on a weekly basis for retirement, and in return, they receive freshly printed bills. 2/3 of this, Honker said, is fatigue currency, and the other million is new and crisp. Don't matter. It'll all spin the same. We just drained some blood out of a capitalist leech, said Crinkles. But his weak metaphor reflected his physical exhaustion. His explosion of wiry hair had gone limp with sweat. Consulting his watch, Punchinello said, we're going to have to shake ass to beat the fireworks. Crinkles and Honker exited the bank's subcellar first, one pulling and the other pushing the handcart. Lori and I followed, with Punchinello close behind us. In Cornelius Snow's secret subterranean corridors, half the fat yellow candles were guttering in the sconces. The quivering flames illuminated the passageway less well than they had done previously. Sinuous figures of light and clawing shadows contested silently on a battlefield of limestone walls and ceiling, like spirits in a war between good and evil. This was one of those places where you wouldn't be surprised if Leatherface from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre turned a corner and fired up his trademark weapon. He might have met his match in the Killer Clowns. Tonight, Punchinello said as we approached the intersection where a right turn would take us to the library. I will finally make my father proud after failing him in everything else. Oh, honey, Lori said, don't be so hard on yourself. You seem to be a whiz on all the gun, knife, poison stuff. That wasn't what mattered to him. All he wanted for me to be was a clown, the greatest clown of all time, a star. But I have no talent for it. You're still young, Lori assured him. Plenty of time to learn. No, he's right, Honker said with apparent earnestness. The boy has no talent for it. It's a genuine tragedy. His father's the Conrad Bezos, so he learned from the greatest. But he can't even do a good pratfall. I love you, Punch, but it's true. No offense, Honker. I faced the truth long ago. At the intersection, we turned neither left nor right. I have my bearings now. Straight ahead will be the Snow Mansion, in front of which I park my Shelby Z, directly across the town square from the bank. Crinkle said, I've been in the ring with Punch, done the exploding clown car routine with him, the foot in the bucket hokum, the rain from under the umbrella skit, even the mouse in the pants number, which nobody can screw up. But I screw them all up, Punchinello said morosely. The audience laughs at him, Honker revealed. Aren't they supposed to laugh at a clown? Lori asked. This isn't good laughter, Punchinello said. Really, miss, it's mean, Honker told Lori. It's laughing at, not with. How can you tell the difference? She wondered. Oh, lady, said Crinkles. If you're a clown, you know. As we proceeded under Central Square Park, I was struck by these two men's change in attitude. They seemed less hostile towards us, positively chatty. Lori was now Miss and Lady instead of It. Maybe the $3 million put them in a better mood. Maybe Punchinello had spoken to him, explained who I was. They might not see us as hostages any longer, but as honorary clowns. Or perhaps they intended to waste us in the next few minutes and preferred to shoot people with whom they had formed a bond. Trying to think like a psychopath, I asked myself, what fun can it be, really, to shoot a virtual stranger? In a mood to flagellate himself, Punchinello revealed, instead of getting my foot stuck in the bucket, I once got my head stuck in the damn thing. That sounds pretty funny, Lori said. Not the way he did it, Honker assured her. They booed, Punchinello said. They booed me out of the big top that night. In front of the handcart, pulling as Honker pushed, wheezing, Crinkle said, you're a good boy, Punch. That's what matters. I'd be proud if you were my son. That's nice, Crinkles. That's really nice. Honker said, what's so great about being a clown anyway? Even when rubes are laughing with you, they're also laughing at you, and the fringe benefits suck. At the end of the passageway, we arrived at another formidable oak door with iron banding. Beyond lay the sub-cellar of the Snow Mansion. The three men produced powerful flashlights with which they revealed this space. The most salient details were the explosive charges set strategically around the enormous room, at the bases of support columns, detonators already inserted. I assumed the fourth key point in the town square, the county courthouse, was likewise wired to blow. Quiet little Snow Village was going to be big news. Bakers are a curious bunch, especially when something in a recipe doesn't seem right. So I asked Punchinello, why flashlights here, but candles in the tunnel? Candles were so authentic out there, he explained. I'm a connoisseur of the authentic whenever it can be found, which is less often every day in this increasingly plastic polyester world. I don't understand. He regarded me with what might have been pity when he said, you don't understand because you're not an artist. That didn't clarify anything for me, but we were already moving on to a spacious 19th century dumbwaiter with a folding brass gate instead of a door. Driven by pulleys and counterweights, it had the capacity and leverage to accommodate the handcart with all the boxes of cash. We climbed four flights of stairs to the kitchen at the back of the house on the main floor. The flashlight beams flared off white ceramic tile counters, polished copper, and the beveled glass and French pane cabinet doors. I spotted a large polished granite insert in one tile counter, the perfect surface on which to work dough for pies and tarts. Even if Cornelius had been the greedy, exploiting, blood-sucking, black-hearted, running dog, drooling, baby-eating pig the Kringles had described, he couldn't have been all bad if he had a particular liking for pastries. Honker said, "Look at this great old iron stove." Kringle said, "Food tasted real coming out of that baby." "Because it was authentic," Punchinello said. Honker put his flashlight on the counter and worked the crank that operated the dumbwaiter cable drive, bringing the proceeds of the bank robbery to the kitchen. Kringle set aside his flashlight too, folded open the brass gate, and pulled the cart into the kitchen. Punchinello shot Honker in the chest, Kringle's in the back, then pumped two more rounds into each of them as they thrashed, screaming, on the floor. Chapter 19. The unexpectedness and ferocity of those murders shocked silence in the lorry, but I think that I screamed. I can't be sure because the screams of the victims, although brief, were ghastly and louder than whatever half-throttle screech might or might not have escaped me. I do know that I almost threw up. Nausea rolled through me, and a sudden flood of bitter saliva insulated my mouth against the acidic rush from my stomach. Clenching my teeth, taking deep, rapid breaths, I swallowed hard and quelled the nausea largely by opening the tap of anger. These killings sickened, frightened, and enraged me even more than did the murder of Lionel Davis, our librarian. I can't say with any certainty why this should be the case. I was physically closer to these victims than the Lionel, who had collapsed out of sight behind his desk instantly upon being shot. Maybe that was it. A proximity to force upon me the very smell of death. Not just the subtle odor of blood, but also the reek of one victim's bowels loosened in his final agonized spasms. Or perhaps I was so powerfully affected because the killer and his two accomplices had been conversing with evident mutual affection such a short time before he had blown them away. The victims were men of low character, no question about that, but so was Punchinello. No matter what breed of miserable lost soul you might be, you deserved at least a safe community of your own kind. Wolves do not kill wolves. Vipers don't attack vipers. Only in the various communities of human beings must brother be on guard against brother. I don't think that's true. I think there's a lot of animals that'll eat their own kids in a moment, in a millisecond. I know that. I've read about it a lot. Like, the moms have to protect the babies from the fathers. So the fathers are fucked up everywhere. But the father will eat the baby. I don't remember where I read about it first. It might have been spiders. Or snakes. It might have been snakes. But I know that somewhere out there, there are parents who will kill their kids as soon as they come out of the mother. Like, immediately. It's like a Zeus sort of thing, or a Kronos sort of thing. As soon as the gods were born, Kronos took them and swallowed them whole. That lesson had been so vividly delivered with six bullets that I felt hammered by cold truth. As the shock knocked the wind out of my lungs, another exhalation escaped my spirit, leaving me two kinds of breathless. Ejecting the magazine that now contained four rounds, inserting a fresh one in the pistol, Punchinello misread our reactions. He grinned, pleased with himself, assuming that we were also pleased with him. "Surprised you, huh? Bet you thought I'd clip him only when we were loaded in the van and out of town with the money. But trust me, this was the best moment." Perhaps if Laurie and I never stumbled into this caper, he would have murdered his companions at this very place. $3 million is a powerful motivator. If he could so coldly execute these men who would seem like uncles to him, however, betraying his promise to us would trouble him no more than jaywalking. "My wedding gift to you," he said, as if he had given us a toaster oven or a tea set and would, in due course, expect a handwritten thank you note. To have called him mad or evil, to have registered revulsion or anger at his ruthlessness, might have invited instant execution. When balancing a bottle of nitroglycerin on the point of a sword, never complicate the task while trying to tap dance. Although I realize that he might read the truth of our feelings and our silence, I can neither find my voice or anything to say. Not for the first time, and certainly not for the last, Lori saved our skin. Would it even begin to be an adequate expression of our gratitude if we named our first son Conrad? I thought this offer would strike him as pure sycophancy and that he would be offended by her obvious attempt to manipulate him. I was wrong. She had struck the perfect note. In the backwash of the flashlight beams, Punchinello's eyes visibly misted with emotion. He bit his lower lip. "That's so sweet," he said. "So kind. I can't think of anything that would please my father, the great Conrad Bezo, more than to know that the grandson of Rudy Tuck was named after him." Lori greeted this response with a radiant smile that Leonardo da Vinci would have given his left foot to paint. "Then all that remains to make me and Jimmy happy is if you would agree to be our baby's godfather." When in the presence of a prince of madness, safety lies, if anywhere, in presenting yourself as a member of that same royal family. More lip biting preceded his emotional reply. "I understand the obligation. I will be little Conrad's protector. Anyone who ever wrongs him will answer to me." "You can't know," Lori told him, "what comfort that gives to a mother." Not as though issuing an order, more as though he were a friend seeking help, he asked us to take the handcart through the rambling historical mansion to the front door. I pushed the cart, and Lori picked out the route with the flashlight. Punchinello followed us with a flashlight in one hand and the pistol in the other. I didn't want him behind my back. I had no choice. If I had hesitated, he might have accelerated through one of his hairpin mood turns. "You know what's ironic?" he asked. "Yeah, that I was worried about going to the dry cleaner." He had no interest in my irony. "What's ironic is that as bad as I am at clowncraft, I'm that good at walking a wire, and I'm at home on a trapeze." Lori said, "You inherited your mother's talent." "And secretly took some training," he admitted as we passed from the kitchen through a butler's pantry into a grand dining room. "If I could have put half the time into those instructions as I put into clowning, I would have been a star." "You're still young," Lori said. "It's not too late." "No. Even if I sold my soul for the chance, I could not become one of them. Never an aerialist. Virgilio Vivacemente is the living god of aerialists and knows them all. If I performed, he would hear of me. He would come to see me. He will recognize my mother's face and mine, and he will kill me." "Maybe he'd embrace you," Lori suggested. "Never. To him, my blood is tainted. He would kill me, dismember me, marinate my remains in gasoline, burn them, urinate on the ashes, put the wet ashes in a bucket, take them to a farm, and stir them into the muddy wallow in the corner of a pig pen." "Maybe you're overestimating his villainy," I suggested as we followed a narrow hall to a wider one. "He's done that very thing before," Punchinello assured me. "He's an arrogant beast. He claims that he's descended from Caligula, the mad emperor of ancient Rome." Having seen Punchinello in action, I couldn't argue against the proposition that he might come from such lineage. He sighed. "That's why I've decided to throw my life away in a frenzy of vengeance. Might as well die if I can't fly." A grand staircase swept up in the gloom from the lavishly detailed foyer. An inlaid black granite and terracotta floor depicted toga-clad figures and mythological beings reminiscent of images on ancient Grecian urns. Our sweeping flashlight beams imparted an illusion of movement to the scenes and the processions underfoot, as if these populations lived in a two-dimensional world as real as our realm of three. A brief dizziness spiraled through me, related less to the patterned floor, I suspect, than to a further delayed reaction to the murders of the two men in the kitchen. In addition, I felt unsteady because I recalled my premonition that Lori would be shot, and I wondered if this might be the place where the trigger would be pulled. My mouth was dry, my hands clammy. I wanted a giddy Claire. Lori gripped my right hand, held it tight. Her elegant fingers were icy. At one of the windows that flanked the pair of tall entry doors, Punchinello extinguished his flashlight, parted the brocade drapery, and scanned the night. No lights anywhere around the square. The detonators in the subcellar of the mansion were ticking toward zero. I wondered how long until everything under us erupted in a blast wave and fire. As if reading my mind, Punchinello turned from the window and said, "We could use more than 7 minutes, but that's all we have." He switched on his light, put it on the floor, fished a handcuff key from a coat pocket and approached me. "I'd like you to roll the handcart down the front steps and across the sidewalk to the back of a yellow van parked at the curb." "Sure, no problem," I said, and cringed at the submissive note in my voice. But I certainly wasn't going to say, "Do it yourself, clown boy." As he keyed open my cuff, I considered trying to wrench the pistol out of his hand. Something about his body language told me that he expected such a move and would counter it brutally and effectively. If Lori was shot, an ill-considered action on my part might be the thing that precipitated her death. Prudence seemed wise, and I didn't go for the gun. I expected him to release her as well. But in a magician quick maneuver, he cuffed himself to her and switched the pistol from his right hand to his left. He held the weapon with such assurance that he appeared to be ambidextrous. Chapter 20. He had cuffed himself to Lori. I saw it happen, yet I needed a moment to accept the reality. I didn't want to believe that our hopes for survival had so abruptly and so drastically diminished. Cuffed together, Lori and I might have tried to break for freedom once we were in the open air. Now she was his hostage, not only for the purpose of holding the police at bay if they should stumble upon us, but also to keep me docile. As for me, Punchinello had decided that if his situation soured in any way, I would be expendable. To question why he cuffed himself to Lori would be to question the sincerity of his promise to spare us. Then things might get ugly sooner rather than later. Consequently, neither Lori nor I indicated that his behavior struck us as odd. This required us to appear as naive as newborns. We were grinning as if we were, gosh, just having the best time. Her smile was fixed like the smiles on Miss America's contestants during the personality competition when the host asked a particularly tricky question. "Miss Ohio, if you saw a puppy and kitten playing on railroad tracks, and a train was coming, and you only had enough time to say one or the other, which would you let die a horrible death? The puppy or the kitten?" My face seemed to have been starched, and my lips felt as if they had been stretched on a clothesline and pinned at both ends. Another Miss Ohio smile. I opened one of the two front doors and pushed the handcart onto the porch. Cool, evergreen-scented air chilled the sweat on the back of my neck. The moon had not yet risen. A skim of clouds let through only prickles of starlight. No lights glowed in the park, and the street lamps had failed. Around the square, the building stood dark and silent. The enormous larches between the sidewalk and the curb screened much of the town from view. Nevertheless, between their branches, I could see a flashing yellow light and power company repair trucks on Alpine Avenue, half a block north of the square. No traffic in the street at this moment. No pedestrians on the sidewalk as far as the overhanging trees would allow me to see. Punchinello and Lori followed me onto the porch. He had left his flashlight inside. In these layered shadows, I could not clearly see his face. That was probably for the good. If I had been able to see him better, I would have read one crazy intention or another in his face and wouldn't have known what to do about it. I wish I could more clearly see Lori. I could tell that her smile had faded. So had mine. The 10 steps between limestone balusters to the public sidewalk. They look steep. I said, I'll have to carry the boxes one or two at a time to the van. The bottom of the handcart's going to get hung up on those steps. No, it won't, he assured me. That's why we bought one with big tires. It'll roll down smooth and easy. But less than 6 minutes, he warned. Don't let the cart get away from you and spill the money. That would be stupid. His admonition was a taunt to the lummox in me, virtually guaranteeing that I would wind up flat on my back on the sidewalk with $3 million tumbled on top of me. I got in front of the handcart and pulled it onto the steps, letting gravity drive it, using my body to prevent it from gaining momentum. Miraculously, I reached the sidewalk without catastrophe. Punchinello and Lori descended after me. I didn't know whether to pray that pedestrians would appear or that we would be left alone. He was so delicately balanced that even an innocent encounter might lead to more murder. Come again, more murder. Where was a judiciously aimed falling safe when you really, really needed one? I pushed the cart to the back of the van. Just 8 feet away stood my Dodge Daytona Shelby Z, a sweet car, and vulnerable. The van doors were unlocked, he said, following me, stopping short of the curb. Load the boxes in the back, and hurry. Although I understood everything about the effects of yeast and about the chemical process by which eggs raise the souffle, I neglected the studies of high explosives. I didn't know what exactly would happen when the boom plastic went off. Yanking open the doors on the back of the van, I imagined the entire front of Snow Mansion collapsing on us, burying us under tons of brick and limestone. Moving boxes from the handcart to the cargo hold of the van, I also imagined the force of the blast tearing us from limb to limb in an instant. 6 boxes, 8 boxes, 10 boxes. In my mind's eye, I saw myself being battered and lacerated and set afire by a storm of blast-propelled debris, blinded and blood-soaked, running along the streets with my hair ablaze. Thank you, Grandma Rowena. As I shoved the last of the boxes into the van, Punchinello said, leave those doors open for now. We'll ride in the back with the money. You can drive. When we got where we were going and I parked the van, he would be behind me, in a perfect position to shoot me in the back of the head. I knew he would do it. The way this guy was behaving, we'd have to find someone else to be little Conrad's godfather. Catch, he said. When I realized he was going to throw the keys to me, I cried out, no, wait. If I missed him, they might go down the street drain, and then we're screwed. Between us lay a 4-foot by 3-foot steel grill with inch-wide gaps between the bars. Walking across it, I caught the faint scent of brackish water below. He held out the keys, and even though the pistol wasn't pointed at me as I approached him, I had a feeling that he would shoot me when I reached for him. More likely, this apprehension arose from my queasy ambiguity about what I intended to do. As I took the keys with my left hand, I swung my right fist in a low origin arc hard into his crotch, driving the nail file deep and no doubt pinning the parts of his mail package into an unprecedented arrangement. In the dark, I could not see the blood drain from his face, but I could almost hear it. Surprising myself with a ruthlessness that I never exhibited or required in a bakery kitchen, I twisted the nail file. Dimly, I recalled that Jack had done something like this to the giant at the foot of the beanstalk, except he used a pitchfork. Letting go of the shiv, I grabbed the ones for the pistol. As he had taken in the nail file, he had let out his breath with a high-pitched sound, half wheeze, half squeal. The file stayed in him. The breath stayed out, and he made dry strangulation noises as he tried to inhale. I expected him to drop the gun, or to have his grip weakened by shock, but he clutched the weapon with grim determination. As she twisted her body and shuffled her feet in a graceless dance, trying to stagger the line of fire, Lori hit Punchinello in the face with her free hand. Hit him again, again, grunting with each blow, exhibiting the machine determination of a figure swinging a hammer at a bell in an animated Swiss clock. We fought over the pistol, my two hands prying at his one, muzzle flashed, shot cracked, and a slug ricocheted off the sidewalk, spraying chips of concrete that tattooed my face, clanging off metal. Maybe LeVan, maybe my sweet Shelby Z. I almost had the weapon, but he managed to squeeze the trigger again, and in spite of all that my father had done for his father, the ingrate shot me. Twice. Chapter 21. If an axe had cleaved my leg, the pain could not have been worse than this. In movies, the hero takes the bullet and keeps on coming. For God, for love of country, for the sake of his woman. A bullet might make him wince, but often it just pisses him off and drives him to even greater heroics. As I said earlier, since childhood I had thought of myself as having the potential to be a hero if put to the test. Now I realize that I lacked at least one essential requirement for the job. A really high pain threshold. Screaming, I fell off the curb and onto the pavement, between the van and the Shelby Z. My head rattled the drainage grill, or maybe the grill rattled my head. I was terrified that he would shoot me in the face, until I realized I had possession of the pistol. Reaching between his legs, he tried to pull the nail file out of his crotch, but merely touching it caused him to squeal more pitifully than a pig catching sight of the butcher's blade. Agony knocked him to his knees. Then he went all the way down, onto his side, pulling Lori with him. We lay there, screaming, Punchinello and I, like two teenage girls who had just found a severed head in an old Jamie Lee Curtis movie. I heard Lori shouting my name and something about time. Unable to focus through the pain, undoubtedly slightly delirious, I found myself imagining what she might be saying. Time waits for no man. Time in the river, how quickly they go by. Time bears away all things. Even in my condition, I quickly realized that she would not be waxing philosophical at a moment like this. When I realized a note of urgency in her voice, I also knew the essence of what she might be saying. Time is running out. The bombs. The pain in my left leg churned with fiery exuberance, and I was surprised to see the flames weren't eating through the flesh. I could also feel something bristling in the meat of it, perhaps shattered bones. I could not, however, move it. How odd to be terrified, but at the same time weary to the point of sleepiness. Racked by pain, yet capable of taking a nap. Pillowy now, the pavement, bedding with a faint fragrance of tar. This tempting slumber was, of course, the sleep of death, which I recognized and resisted. Making no attempt to stand, dragging the useless leg after me as if I was Sisyphus and it were my stone, I scaled the towering curb. I crawled to Lori. Lying on his side, one arm behind him, Punchinello remained cupped to Lori. With his free hand, he plucked the nail file out of his crotch and promptly threw up on himself. I was gratified by this evidence that he felt worse than I did. During the past few hours, I had come to believe in the reality of evil for the first time in 20 years. I believe suddenly not merely in evil as a necessary antagonist in movies and books, bad guys and boogeymen. Not merely in evil as a consequence of parental rejection or parental indulgence or social injustice, but in evil as a presence alive in the world. It's a presence that tirelessly romances and beguiles, but it cannot consummate a relationship until invited to do so. Punchinello might have been raised by an evil man, might have been instructed in the linguistics of evil, but ultimately the choice of how to live was his alone. My gratification at the sight of his suffering might have seemed unwholesome, corrupting, but I don't believe that it was itself a small evil. At the time it felt, and even now feels, like righteous satisfaction prompted by this proof that evil has a price to extract from those who embrace it, and that resistance to it, while costly, might have a lower cost than acquiescence. Funny how much windy philosophy can be inspired by a little puke. One man's regurgitation, even if it might give rise in him to some remorse, couldn't stop the ticking of a single detonator. We must have had at most a minute or two before the works of Cornelius Rutherford Snow fell into ruin nearly as complete as the Empire of Ozymandias. Gimme, Lori said. What? The gun. I hadn't realized I still had the pistol. Why? I asked. I don't know what pocket he put the key in. We didn't have time to search the pockets in his pants, coat, or shirt. Considering the vomit, we didn't have the inclination either. I failed to understand what the gun had to do with the handcuff key. I worried that she would hurt herself, so I decided not to give her the pistol. Then I realized she had already taken it out of my hand. "You've already taken that out of my hand," I said, and my voice sounded slurred. "Better turn your face away," she warned. "There might be shrapnel." "I think I like shrapnel," I replied, unable to remember what the word meant. She fumbled with the gun, squinting at it in the dark. "I don't think I hurt as much as I used to hurt," I told her. "Now I'm mostly cold." "That's bad," she said worriedly. "I've been cold before," I assured her. Punchinello groaned, shuddered, and began to upchuck on himself again. "Have we been drinking?" I wondered. "Turn your face away," Lori said, this time sharply. "Don't talk so mean to me. I love you." "Yeah, well, we always hurt the one we love," she said, grabbing a fistful of my hair and pulling my face away from the handcuffs. "That's sad," I said, meaning that we always hurt the one we love. And then I discovered I was lying on the sidewalk and must have fallen. Lummox. A gun boomed, and I didn't realize until later that she had put the muzzle of the pistol against the links of chain that connected one handcuff to the other, and had freed herself from Punchinello with that shot. "On your feet," she urged me. "Come on, come on." "I'll lay here till I'm sober." "You'll lay there till you're dead." "No, that's too long." She cajoled me, she cursed me, she commanded me, pushed and yanked and pulled, and the next thing I knew, I was on my feet, leaning on her, moving between the van and my Shelby Z, into the street, away from the mansion. "How's your leg?" "What leg?" "I mean, what about the pain?" "I think we left him back there on the sidewalk." "God, you're a Hulk," she said. I'm a little husky, that's all." "It's all right. It's okay. Lean on me. Come on." In a voice now as thick as English custard, I said, "Are we going to the park?" "That's right." "Picnic?" "That's right. And we're late, so let's hurry." I peered past Lori, towards the sound of an approaching engine. Headlights washed across us. An array of revolving blue and yellow beacons on the roof indicated that it was either a police cruiser or an intergalactic vehicle. The car slid to a halt, doors flew open, and two men got out about 15 feet away. One of them said, "What's going on here?" "This man is shot," Lori told them. I wonder who she was talking about. Before I could ask, she said, "We need an ambulance." The cops approached warily. "Where's the shooter?" "Over there, on the sidewalk. He's hurt. Doesn't have a gun anymore." When the officers moved towards Punchinello, Lori shouted, "No! Stay back. The building's gonna blow." In my condition, her warning was mystifying. It didn't seem to make sense to the police either. They hurried towards Punchinello, who lay half revealed in the backwash of the squad car lights. With single-minded determination, Lori kept moving me towards the park. "Too cold for a picnic," I said. "So cold." "We'll build a bonfire. Just move." My teeth chattered and words shivered out of me. "Will there be potato salad?" "Yes, plenty of potato salad." The pickly kind?" "Yes, that's right. Keep moving." "I hate the pickly kind." "We have both kinds." Another curb almost defeated me. The sidewalk looked soft and inviting. "It's too cold for a picnic," I said, "and too dark." An instant later, it was also too noisy. Chapter 22. The four virtually simultaneous explosions, mansion, bank, courthouse, library, purged confusion from my mind. For a moment, I could think too clearly. As the ground rocked, as the evergreens in the park swayed and shook off dead needles, as the initial blast gave way to the mad god's bowling clatter of stone structures collapsing, I remember being shot twice and not enjoying it either time. The pain didn't return with the memory, and now I was clear-headed enough to understand that being unable to feel my leg at all was worse than the fiery agony that I had first endured. The utter lack of feeling suggested that the leg was damaged beyond repair, already dead, amputated, gone. Exhausted, I stumbled when the ground rocked. Lori helped me lower myself to the grass, where I leaned against the trunk of a sycamore, even as the final blast quaked through the town square. With the memory of being shot came a nightmare montage of the three murders that Punchinello had committed in front of me. These bloody images were more vivid in recollection than at the time of the killings. Perhaps because then I had been so concerned with my own and Lori's survival that I dared not consider consciously the hideous details for fear of being paralyzed by terror. Sickened, I tried to repress those memories, but they tormented me. All my life, I had been comfortable inside my own head, but now that interior landscape was bloodstained and darkened by an ominous eclipse. When I wished for the comforting return of the haze to which I had earlier succumbed, it came immediately in a great gray wave, drowning the lights of the police car on the street, then seething through the trees as might rich billows of wind-driven fog, which was curious on a windless night. Dust. The turbulent mass proved to be neither fog nor mental haze, but thick clouds of fine dust expelled from Cornelius Snow's mansion as it crashed down from imposing edifice to shattered ruin. Pulverized limestone, powdered brick, crushed plaster, and 1,000 scents and flavors, dust rolled over us. Pale as it approached, the cloud brought darkness when it fell upon us, a gloom deeper than the lightless night itself. I eased away from the sycamore and rolled onto my right side, closing my eyes, pulling my shirt up to mask my nose and mouth against the choking dust. I reached down with one hand to touch my numb left leg, to reassure myself that it was still there. My hand came away slick with warm blood. In what seemed but an instant, dust caked the blood and formed a grisly plaster around my hand. At first I thought that Lori must have dropped to the grass beside me, covering her face against the suffocating paw. Then I heard her voice above me and knew she remained on her feet. She called for an ambulance, coughing, wheezing, ceaselessly calling for help. Help! A man's been shot. I wanted to reach for her, pull her down, but I had no strength to raise my arm. A fearsome weakness overcame me. The comforting mental haze that I wished for had now returned. Frantic about Lori, I no longer wanted this escape, but resistance was impossible. My thoughts wove an incoherent narrative of hidden doors, candlelit tunnels, dead faces, gunshots, snake handlers, tornadoes, clowns. Soon I must have been unconscious and dreaming, for I had become an aerialist, walking the high wire, using a long pole for balance, progressing tentatively and precariously toward the platform on which Lori waited. When I glanced behind to see what distance I had already traveled, I found Punchinello Beasel in pursuit of me. He carried a balancing pole too, but each side of it terminated in a wickedly sharp blade. He was smiling, confident, and faster than I was. He said, "I could have been a star, Jimmy Talk. I could have been a star." Occasionally, I drifted from big top dreams and from secret passageways in my soul and realized that I was being moved, carried in a litter, then strapped on a gurney in a rollicking ambulance. When I tried to open my eyes but could not, I told myself they were simply glued shut by dust and tears. I knew this would be a lie, but I took comfort from it anyway. Eventually, someone said, "The leg can't be saved." I don't know if that was a person in a dream or a real doctor, but I responded in a voice that sounded to me like if I had been a frog prince. "I need both legs. I'm a storm chaser." Thereafter, I sank uncounted fathoms into an abyss where the dreams were too real to be dreams, where a mysterious behemoth stood guard over me, but always at the periphery of vision, and where the air smelled of cherry tart flambé.
916-633-1537, wretchedandratchet@gmail.com, Ratchet Book Club on Twitter, Ratchet Book Club on Facebook. You can leave a review on Spotify. It takes like 13 seconds. You can also leave a review on Podchaser. Copy and paste that into Apple Podcasts, and then copy and paste that into the Good Pods app. You can donate to the show at patreon.com/singlesimulcast. $1 will get you a ton of content. You can also donate to the show at buymeacoffee.com/sscast or on the Good Pods app. You can leave a tip in the tip jar. Thank you so much for listening. I greatly appreciate it. Y'all be good. I'ma holler at you later. Peace. Intro and outro to Ratchet Book Club is by That Kid Garan, and it's called Goodbyes. You can email him at tkgbeats94@gmail.com for more information on how to lease this beat.
This is Single Simulcast.